The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect. All are humble and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Join us at whatiwishinewshow.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And please share and subscribe to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Simon Dorr and Mike Irwin. We're pleased today to have venture capitalist Brian Finnerty with us. And Brian's background is so unique. He's founder and chairman of Opportunity Seed Capital, which is an investment firm that invests in sports and technology, but really with an overlap of giving back to the community, which I think is uncommon with VCs. So we're interested in hearing about that. And amongst the many investments that Brian has is in V1 Sports, which is a leading sports training app, Galway Bay Apparel, which is golf apparel. And then he also owns High Velocity Sports, which is a large sports training facility located near Detroit. But all of his success in business is built on the back as an athlete. And so prior to his venture capital work, he also was the founder and CEO of ProtectCell, which was, I believe, one of the first companies that not only insured devices like mobile phones and tablets, but also insured the data and the identity, you know, kind of behind it. So we'll hear that story. But again, it all started with sports. And Brian is a Detroit sports legend. He spent 10 years playing professional soccer in Detroit and earned, you know, an amazing reputation around the community. And so we're interested in kind of hearing, you know, where you kind of came from on the sports side too. So Brian, thanks so much for joining us. And maybe you can kind of give us a quick rundown on how did you get here?
Well, first I got to hire you as my agent. That's start going through some of those things like, wow, that's great. You know, I originally came from San Diego, just north. I grew up in Dana Point, California. I've always loved sport. Soccer happened to be my thing. I played a little bit of baseball. But in a nutshell, how I got here is I followed my passion. And I think that is a totally overblown statement in today's thing. You know, if you just follow your passion, and we're going to probably unpack a lot of that today, but quite frankly, and my wife, you know, will probably wrangle me later because she followed my passion with me and allowed a lot of that freedom to happen. As a team, as a partnership, we got married when we were 23, right after my rookie year. But I was able to follow my passion. And quite frankly, playing soccer turned into owning a facility, turned into coaching teams, turned into building teams, turned into growing teams. You know, to take sport out of my life, you might as well put me in the grave. So, you know, I'm here because of the passion in sport, certainly a drive to win, but I love being part of a high-performing team. And that's whether it's cell phone insurance and device mobility, all the way out to V1 Sports and helping students get better with their instructors. So I think there's a great range that sports certainly kind of weaves the fabric of.
That's fascinating. So if we start kind of back, you know, in your California days, I mean, is this something that you would have foreseen? Like if we were talking to, you know, 18-year-old Brian Finnerty, would he be surprised on what's happened since?
Oh, gosh. You know, yes, I would be. My parents certainly would be, and my friends would be. You know, I'd be probably voted most likely to be in a Tijuana jail before I would be, you know, running an investment company and a foundation at the same time. Yeah, it's been a pretty miraculous journey, you know, and I don't use that word lightly. It's been a miracle. There have been twists and turns that I don't believe in luck. So I will probably, you'll hear that enough times to say maybe edit it out. I do believe being prepared for an opportunity is key. For sure, that's in the fabric of my life. But for me, I've looked back on my life and said, wow, okay, I can see where the pieces fit together. But at 18, I'd love to have told you I was this driven, you know, motivated guy who knew, you know, he's going to retire at 43. Not a chance. The only thing I knew is I wanted to play pro soccer. Literally beg, borrow, or steal. I worked on a fishing boat to make enough money to not have to work during soccer season. I was a happy guy. Working on a fishing boat, playing soccer, it seemed pretty good to me. And my only goal is to play pro ball. And when that started to happen, it was like, wow, okay, then what's next? So, you know, we could go on forever on that one. Shocking would be the I think key word there for sure, or miraculous for sure.
Just on that then, Brian, you talked about, you know, moving in and seizing the opportunities and moving in, for instance, into your first role. But what is in Brian then that you took, for instance, from the sports field or from what you did around that area that, if you like, is part of your DNA or makes you what you are and successful as you built a companies?
That's a great question, Simon. So again, in reflection, not in preparation back to, you know, 18 through 24. But the one thing that has been a common thread that I have certainly shared with I have twin boys that are 19, both going to their sophomore year in college. We spend a lot of time with Young Life in our community. And as Mike knows, in many places, mentorship. For me, it is that sort of preparedness meets opportunity, that it's what you do when people are not looking, right? So to use your question for sports, I was a walk-on at San Diego State. I was recruited to play James Madison University, took one recruiting trip there, being a kid from California, go to the East Coast in November, and you're like, okay, not for me. I don't see any waves. I don't see any girls in bikinis. Probably not the right spot for me. School looks pretty hard. So San Diego State looked like a pretty good option for me. But even as the four-string goalkeeper, so I was a walk-on, which essentially is a water boy. I mean, let's call it what it is. You're carrying bottles. You're setting up and taking down cones. You're carrying the sweaty bibs around. I trained as if I was going to be a starter. And I can remember my friends literally saying, you are cuckoo. You're crazy. You are never going to get a chance. The kids who get recruited get to play. When coaches invest in scholarship, that's who they're going to play. I just didn't believe it, and call that a false sense of, you know, reality, but I believed I was good enough to play. When I looked out on the field, I said, yeah, I think I can hang here. So I have a lot to learn for sure. So I prepared like I was going to play. Fast forward I redshirted a year, sat the bench for another year. And so now in the second and a half year, haven't played a minute, haven't played a game. I think most people would say, maybe I'm a little delusional at this point. I'm third string, starting goalkeeper breaks his leg. The second goalkeeper goes in and literally subs back out in about 30 seconds, violently throwing up, so nervous in the situation. And the coach looks down the bench and he's like, unless we put a field player in goal, Finnerty, you're in. And quite frankly, I already had thought about being in that spot and had a chance to get six straight shutouts. Wow. You know, the rest is kind of history. I got to play the rest of my career at San Diego State and then get drafted to play pro. So I believe that's the first half. And the other is when you get it, don't let it go. Right. Yeah. So Cal Ripken probably will talk a lot about that. But that to me is an important part, that once you get it, if you kind of say, wow, I've arrived, the next Brian Finnerty is going to be on your tail. I mean, for me, it was, I knew what it took to get there. No one was going to outwork me. No one was going to outprepare me, almost to a fault. Right. I mean, and there's a darker side to that. But I think in those early drive days, it was once I got there, no one was going to unseat me from that spot.
But what did you do, Brian, that was different? Because you and the rest of the team and the guys above you, I guess, all had the same 24 hours in a day. What did Brian do different?
I was consistent. You know, I wish I had some sexy magic thing to say about, you know, I did this special training thing or I adopted this routine that has a quick buzzword to it. Quite frankly, there's maybe a sexier word than consistent, but I just trained hard every day. I was prepared every day. One thing I've shared with my boys as they got ready to play soccer in college is neither one of them going in as a, you know, a meant to be starter. Both of them got a chance to play meaningful minutes as freshmen, which was great. But, you know, be let down when you don't play. Don't be surprised that you do. And I remember that as a kid that's 18 years old. that I never wanted to be sitting on the bench and suddenly be surprised I was going into a game. I wanted to leave the field after the 90 minutes and be pissed that I didn't play, even as a third string goalie, because I knew the next day there was something to train. I didn't want to be sitting in that spot on the bench. I literally would have nightmares about this. I'm not kidding you. Some people say they're driving a car and there's no steering wheel. To me, it was sitting on the bench and the coach pointed me ready to go in, and I don't have my goalie gloves. I'm not prepared. I don't know who we're playing. And it was kind of a weird environment. So my only thing was just consistently be ready to start. And, you know, it happened. And once it did, I kind of felt like, okay, this is my place.
So do you feel on that stuff, Brian, then that kind of intense focus also is reflected in the other side of gratitude of like, man, I got this chance. So therefore, you know, I'm going to recognize it. And do you see that? Does that apply in life as well?
For sure. I'd love to tell you again, you know, young 18-year-old Brian was super humble and thankful. You know, that'd be, you know, the missed years in my life. And in the early stages of my marriage were that lack of that, that it was sort of this, I believed I was who was on the field. And this thing about like, you are that identity, or you're this score you shoot on a golf course. That's a pretty dangerous position. And I lived it, right? So looking back, man, the humility and thankfulness, humility to say, wow, I am here. And it's not luck, right? I am humbly here. Coaches believed in me. Teammates rallied around me. Opportunity was ready when I was ready. There's a lot to be in there. And then being thankful for it is really acknowledging it's not about you, right? And so I think when I've had so many moments of happiness based in that, that when I look back on 18 to 24, 25 and think, had I just been more humble and thankful instead of so driven and determined about, you know, keeping a leg up instead of pulling some people up, you know, the young freshman goalkeeper coming in when I was a senior, I wanted nothing more than to not let him start. The guy that was a junior is now my brother-in-law. He's still my best friend. He'll tell you, Curtis McAllister, who's a coach at Santa Clara women's program, I was an a-hole. I mean, I was ruthless. You know, he'll say, yeah, it helped him to get better, but it certainly didn't build better friendships until after I left. And so he ended up marrying my wife's sister and now her brother-in-laws. But no, I wish I had those years back to be humble and thankful. Because again, I think those are a little bit of buzzy words right now, but if you really weave them into your life and humbly you think about how you got there, and you truly are thankful for all of the people, all of the opportunities, all the events that may have transpired, you start playing them backwards. To me, you land on words like miracle, because you're just like, man, I just can't believe that all fell into place, unless you believe in luck. And then it's like every day you flip a coin and hope you get there. Yeah. But that humility and thankfulness is, I think, you know, that would be an important part that I definitely share with young guys today, whether it's in business, young guys going into marriage or courting their girlfriends. That humility and thankfulness, it's not just about business, not just about sports. I mean, it is it's when we raise our kids. What better way for me to teach my boys about being young men than to teach them to be humble and thankful? Because the first thing they're going to ask, what do you mean? It's not about me? Actually, it's kind of not. So yeah, it's a good place.
How do people then practice if they feel or they're self-reflect and they don't feel they're humble enough or thankful enough? How do they practice that?
Okay, so I'll give you a real life one from my son Owen, who's a goalkeeper at University of Michigan. Got a chance to play, ironically, when the starting goalkeeper broke his leg, so he got a chance to get in there, and I could see some of this bravado coming out. And I've tried different ways to share with Owen that this humility and thankfulness is important. He's certainly seen it for 19 years. I bought him a journal. And for him, it unlocked a little bit of that thinking. And my only request, ask of him was every day, Owen and I are very similar. Josh is very much like his mom. So with Owen, there's this passion, this, you know, like there's a little bit of, you know, what does tomorrow have in store? It was slow down enough every morning and write just two things that you were thankful that happened yesterday that had nothing to do with you, right? Just two things that you're thankful for. And over the course of a month, I want you to, on the first day of the month, sit down, grab a cup of coffee, do whatever you do. He loves to fish. Get out on a boat. Before you cast the first line, reflect on 60 things that happened in a month that you can look back on and say, had nothing to do with you. Somebody poured into your life. An event happened. God's at work in your life. There's a lot of things going on, but you think in 1 month, 60 things, and that's only if you write two a day. And it's a practice I do too. So it's not like, hey, this sounds like a great idea for you. Obviously it's like, what's your journal look like, Dad? And it was nice to open it up. And the wow factor for him was, you know, like, wow, that's a month during COVID. This is, you know, things that you've been thankful for, and you just see these events. So Simon, I think just writing it down, right? Because if you think about it, it's one thing. And again, that's just one guy's opinion. I think writing it down gives it this place that, at least in reflection, you know, I'd love to tell you it's second nature for me. I do have a hard time forward thinking humility. I have to be reflective and like, wow, that happened to me. That happened with me, my family, my wife, my friends, you know. So just writing it down helps for me a ton. And that's just two things a day. It takes 10 minutes, 5 minutes. Sometimes it takes an hour because the pages fill up with, my goodness, I didn't think that was a big event yesterday. And look what poured out of that.
That's real practical help there, Brian, yeah? Just writing it. Because like you say, you can fill your brain with ideas and reflections, but then the day's gone and you're onto a new day. So it's a really helpful idea there.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
So as you moved in into professional soccer, maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, you had great success, you won championships, but then you also had like a business side to your professional career too. Maybe you could share a bit about that.
Well, unlike, you know, basketball, football, and baseball, and hockey as well, we weren't certainly getting paid enough that I was making retirement plans while playing pro soccer. So there was some sort of the battle of necessity. And also, as my teammates will tell you, I am such a voracious learner. And I think some of that was coming with humility. So about midway through my career, about that 24, 25, 26 year old level, it was, hey, this isn't going to be forever. it's a really great living, and to get paid to play a game, I'm not sure if there is a better job in the world, quite frankly. Especially, you know, one that feeds the ego, which can be damaging, but then also says you're being rewarded for hard work and for using a gift that you were given that wasn't yours. So, you know, for me, it was just taking the small opportunities to do extra. I mean, playing soccer, we were 3 hours a day plus travel on the weekends, and we only had a 7.5-8 month season, including playoffs. So you had 4 months where you can play golf every day if you wanted to. A lot of guys just go home to their families. As I mentioned, we were owned by the Illich family, and they had said in the fourth or fifth year of my career, I was signed the first ever 4-year guaranteed no cut, no trade contract in soccer, for indoor soccer. The Illiches wanted to keep me around. The World Cup had just hit here in the U.S. We had hosted here in Detroit. Soccer was at a fever pitch, and they really wanted to have, you know, a couple of players they could build a franchise around. I happened to be lucky enough to be one of those guys. And I'll never forget, Atanas Illich said, in the off season, you can work anywhere in our organization that you want. You're still going to get paid the same amount of money, but anywhere you want. You can sit next to the CEO. You can sit next to the director of marketing. Anywhere you want, you can come in. Just, you know, obviously you got to get permission and then be part of that team, and you can move around. So it was almost like a paid internship. And what I learned was the value of real estate. I mean, I kind of knew that. I was always an entrepreneur at heart. I'd owned some businesses, ran my own summer camps, which were nice. You know, it was good filler business, but I really understand the power of real estate. So I started to build 4-unit strip malls, and we would build those units, fill up the end tenants with a good friend of mine owned some cell stores, which is how I got into cell insurance, and another good friend owned oil change places. And so they'd become anchor tenants. We'd sell those buildings at a nice profit and then kind of rinse, wash, repeat. So, you know, a blend between the summer camp businesses that my wife and I are running and moving into real estate. I won't say it was easy, but I had a lot of downtime and I was already getting paid. So, you know, it was kind of like, why not? I hate to be flippant about that, but that was kind of, might as well, because, you know, again, there's going to be life after soccer. And rather than some employer looking at my resume going, hey, what'd you do for the last 11 years? Because I kind of see graduation and then I see it 33 years old and you got a family of four. So yeah, it was a really good transition.
So how did you then, you know, moving on, you know, so you do that, you play professional soccer. At that point, when you decided, you know, to call it a day or call it a career, what were you thinking then, and what led you into, you know, the cell insurance side of it?
Well, when I left, pro soccer, so Denise is pregnant with the twins. I get my guaranteed contract because we got bought out by the Davidson family who owned the Pistons at the time. They were able to nullify all of our contracts. So my contract was ended, which was a big surprise. I was now my second batch of 4 years of my guarantee. And I kind of knew that this was going to be my last year playing. I wanted it to be my swan song. In Detroit, great sports town, and just wasn't going to happen. So Mr. Belante in Buffalo had said, we'll get you a house here. We'll take care of your wife. I got paid very handsomely to go. We know it'll be your last season. And essentially, we'll help you kind of set up the next stage in life. I didn't know what that was going to be. A very, very good friend who I hadn't really met that well at the time, Frank Tanana, who pitched for the Angels and the Tigers. I got to meet him through a couple of different Bible studies. And I asked Frank, I said, hey, when you retired, what do you regret, or what did you love? And he's a very transparent guy. And, his story is pretty well documented. But he said he had some dark times leaving baseball because of the clamor to get back. And the moment you leave, somebody wants you back. And so this drive to get back, and you never know when to leave. His advice was find the next thing. Find the next thing that you're passionate about that will drive you and certainly be something you want to do. I knew from traveling around the world, I'd seen hundreds of sports facilities around the globe. I wanted to open up one. And so Denise and I really decided that we'd use all the money that we made while playing in Buffalo to be essentially our down payment to open a sports facility in Canton, Michigan. And that would be our next. So that was our next business. Literally retired in April of 2000. We opened up Christmas of that year. April of 2001. My boys were born in February 01, retired in April of 01, and then we opened up Christmas of 2001 and been in business for 20 years, right? We wanted to create a legacy in the community. So we still own that business. We've grown and sold other businesses along the way. And then about 8 years into that business, stayed good friends with my buddy who owned the cell phone stores. And then he wanted to do a cell phone insurance program that then becomes, a whole other journey. But it was kind of just an evolution of things. But the sports facility was really that transition, because I had believed in my life that I was Brian Finnerty, the pro soccer player. That was my name, actually. I wasn't Brian Finnerty, the good husband. I wasn't Brian Finnerty, soon to be father. I wasn't Brian Finnerty having a good influence with young men in the community. I was Brian Finnerty, the pro soccer player. And win or lose, that was my attitude, my position. It was a fleeting place to be, right? And it's a trap, because when we believe those things, then leaving the game, you're like, who am I? What am I? What am I doing? And so every team that would call, and then there were a lot of calls that came, hey, we need a goalkeeper. We'll sign you for X money, be a free agent for a month while our guy gets back. I would make more in a month than I would in half a season. The drive was there, but I had settled on that. That is not who I am, right? I'm father, a husband, now a business owner. It helped in that transition.
So on that facility then, now I'm guessing that many of the kids that come through your facility, they wouldn't necessarily know you as, Coach Brian, the soccer player, right? So why have you kept with that business, and what is it that you, aside from, the business part of it, but does it give you something that, or enable you to do things that you feel are important now?
Absolutely. And I'll sum it up this way, because this was also, I started a consulting business to build sports facilities. It felt it was so impactful in my life. It still is today, 20, almost 1 years later. If I asked most people that would want to build the next High Velocity, what does sport mean for you and what has it done in your life? Some will look up to the left. They go into la la land and they rekindle some really, really deep feelings about how it shaped their life. Others, with no motion, would say, the parking lot looks full and it's a great ROI. And I'd say, never own a sports facility. The ROI is okay. It's a tough business, but I'm in it today because if I took the two of you guys into that facility in 5 minutes, you'd be smiling from ear to ear. You would feel the love and the laughter. Even in COVID, we're feeding 260 families a day with drive-through food. we're not doing any sport. We're closed completely. We've got 270,000 square feet that is not a sports facility today. We're in the middle of changing it to be an educational secondary option for parents whose schools go back part-time. The joy and the happiness that exists in there, our staff loves the building. It's clean. You know, we believe it has to be clean, run appropriately, and be fair, right? And a little bit about what we talked earlier. And fair has a very deep meaning, way before what is in front of us now. I'd say at High Velocity, we sit right on the border of Detroit, Ypsilanti, which socioeconomically has almost 30% of their kids on the free lunch program, and then Canton, Michigan, which has a high white-collar population. So we sit in this triangle of a great melting pot, huge Chaldean population, an Indian population. It is so magical to be in that place. I mean, I go on, clearly I'm excited about it, but you can see the two Iranian teams that are beating the snot out of each other, wrap their arms around each other right when they get off the field. And as an American player, as a parent of the kids coming on the field next, they're ready to call the police. And I'm like, this is part of the culture of soccer for them. When it happens on our field, it's in a safe, clean environment that's run well. It happens, right? It's magic. You get 8-year-olds kicking the ball for the first time and parents looking around saying, this is what it's supposed to be. I don't know whether you turn a profit or not. It's a pretty magical place. So I can't see us ever not owning High Velocity.
Ryan, I get the sense, well, the true strength from what you're describing. And you talked about earlier what you learned when you're in the football, in the soccer game towards the end and getting trained. This softer skills piece, and we talk about what I wish I knew, but this softer skills piece is very paramount and is something that I'm feeling here. I mean, just tip back before you carry on with this story, though. You talked about this kind of what I feel is a mentoring program that you had when you were at the soccer team. Is that something that you take with you? Is that your style of leadership? Is that something you would bestow on people in the world at any stage of career?
It is. I don't think, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. To me, if you're old enough, you're good enough, right? And if you're good enough, you're old enough. I think we get limited by age. Well, I can't do anything because I'm only 23 and I just don't have enough experience to give. I'd say if you look into that high school, my guess is you look like a legend, right? For the 30-year-old that's clamoring at Ford to try to just get out of a cubicle and says, I'm just not sure I have enough time. I'd say, hey, let's look around and what do you love to do? My guess is I can take you within 4 blocks of your house and we can find a lot of places, right? So the time, treasure, and talent piece, I don't believe it's age-based. I honestly think that's BS completely. I hear a lot of leadership teachers talk about you got to be in the second half of your life. You know, all the analogies of you got to have enough wisdom that's accumulated through knowledge. And I don't disagree that that's helpful. But mentorship and give back, the give in is what you get back. So yes, I'm sorry. I look at it and say it's foundational. It's not optional. So in our staff, in any of our companies, we talk a lot. First and foremost, they know that I love them, and it's not BS. If I don't, this is the wrong place for you, wrong place for me. So you should know that I love you. I love what you do, and we care deeply about your families and what we do, whether it's High Velocity, V1 Sports, Galway Bay, or the foundation. So that you know that you are loved for sure. Then who else can you say that you love that isn't in your immediate sphere of influence? And again, going back to magical and miraculous, I've seen transformation like no other when people reach outside of their normal thing and start to look in their community. You don't have to get on a plane and go to Africa or Haiti. You can find it in Detroit. You can find it in San Diego, in any zip code. You can find it in England, in any zip code. It's right there in front of you. You're willing just to invest, because then you ask, what can I do to help, right? Not how do I solve your problem? What can I do to help? And then you turn your ears on. It's transformational. I mean, it is. It sounds so simple. Again, it's not super sexy. But when it becomes part of the culture, then not doing it feels very odd. And doing it feels very inviting. So yeah, it's an important part for us for sure.
You know, I think that's a massive statement, you know, Brian, because what you're talking about there, you know, you say foundational, but in a lot of ways, you know, the world's a better place because of people like that, because people like you, because people see that, you know, the servant leadership isn't just something I do in a work role or whatever, or a church role, but it's actually something I can do in my life.
Well, we say this in the interview process. And again, this is whether I'm working with nonprofits at Young Life or to one of my companies or a board that I might sit on, that at the end of the day, who you are on Saturday is also the person on Wednesday, who's also the person on Friday, that's the person on Sunday. If you have to be two different people based on the workplace or at home, either you've got the wrong workplace or you need to sort of reset the priorities. I'm not saying you can't have fun on a Saturday night, don't get me wrong, or, you know, but if you love skiing and you love volunteering in your community, man, I hope you're bringing that into the workplace. I hope that you're corralling other people about, hey, let's see if we can do a 4-day work week this week to get up for a 3-day ski trip with our families. How magical would that be? Hey, we've got an opportunity to volunteer in Detroit to teach soccer to 7- and 8-year-olds who, quite frankly, have never seen a soccer ball. It's intimidating. Anybody in with me? Because you saw me on Monday when I came back from the last one. I was floating on air. You couldn't wipe the smile off my face. It's contagious, right? So, yeah, again, this is just my view. I'm sure Fortune 500 companies might feel a little differently. For us, we want you to be who you are all the time. Again, obviously, there's nuances to that. But that freedom that comes with being able to do that, it is contagious. Workplace and life and those two things, when they start to blend, you find that your values aren't different. Your character doesn't have to be different. I don't know. Makes it pretty fun, to be honest with you.
A point with that then, Brian, where and your teams and the success is prevalent, and like you said, that warmth, you know, and culture, is there a situation where you don't want to leave, it's not quite right, where I wouldn't say you impose your style, which may be different, and warming, or do you walk away? I mean, what's your learning, if you like, over the years?
You know, I'll give it to you in terms of what we do with our interview process and partnerships. I hopefully that answers the question, Simon. So we changed, when I invested in B1 Sports, I think it's a good example. It's now a 25-year-old company. It's a golf technology company that was really poised. It's a video capture environment. So if you've ever watched golf on Sundays, when they show a player in slow motion and they draw a circle around his head or the shaft lean, that's all of our technology. We do it for about 10,000 golf pros in the US. We've got about 4 million golfers that use our app to connect with a golf pro. So we believe in that, right? In terms of the transfer of data between the two. When I took over the company as CEO 4 years ago, so we helped the founder transition out. That was part of his desire with the investment. He wanted to transition out. I brought in a transitional CEO, and then oddly enough, in the quest to find our new, the board of directors said, that kind of sounds like it should be you. And I just didn't step back fast enough. So I inherited a job that I didn't want. I was supposed
to be
retired. Yeah. We went from 26 employees down to 11, made more money in that year than we had in the previous 10. We're now back up to 30 people. And I share that because it came out of this exact thing. That as we shifted the culture, it was either you believe in it and this is the right place. Of the, I think 14 of the 16 people that decided to leave us, I personally helped transition out. So it wasn't like you're fired, get out of here. It was them walking in and saying, this just doesn't feel like the right place for me. Either the scar tissue built up is, you know, doesn't make it good, or where you want to go, I'm just not in for that. I'd like to get here at 8:59 and leave at 4:59. Which just doesn't work in this culture, right? We kind of get in and we dig. So as we pared the team down, we also fired 50 of our pretty valuable customers, and we got rid of 2 of the 3 of our most valuable partners. Because we also have a mantra that is, we're not going to work with, and you put, you know, a-hole, however you get, well, you don't have to bleep it out. It's actually in our business. It's on the walls that we believe that our people are the most important. That's all part of this culture. So the customer's not always right. And in the hiring process, we make sure that who we're talking to understands all of these. These core values are key. We want to win. We make no bones about it. We're a competitive environment. The products we build are meant to dominate in the marketplace. Well, if you're not a competitive person and you don't really like that, and you don't feel like a thoroughbred, it's going to be a pretty uncomfortable place. And so we say, we'd rather you know that now. We're going to be very transparent with you. I'm in every one of the hiring opportunities. So it's not, hey, staff, go get it, and we'll see how it works out. I want them to sit with me and hear from the horse's mouth that this is what you are walking into. I can't tell you how many really, really superstar, high-quality candidates called us back and said, I just don't think that's the right place for me. Fantastic. You just saved me 3 months of training, countless dollars, distractions in my workplace, and you probably didn't leave a job you needed to leave. Good for you too. We deal with our partners. This is the company we're going to build. We're going to be in a win-win. We're going to be transparent about our profit margins with your products or with your services. You know, the old sort of conscious capitalism thinking, right? That if it's not a win for us, it's not going to be a win for you. During COVID, our company's grown 60%, 60 at V1 Sports, because we've been able to help our partners that are golf pros were struggling for about 45 days. We paused things for them, gave them the opportunity to say either start teaching online, which would be a new avenue for you, or if you just can't do anything, we're here to help you out. We knew what that looked like. To the same degree, those that were crushing it stayed on with us, and some of them called us to say, hey, do you need us to pay our subscriptions forward? Who's having that happen in business, right? But we're aligned with the right people. So again, sorry for the long diatribe on that, but it isn't just about, you know, that old culture workplace thing that's printed on a wall. It's, are you living it? Are you doing it? Are you hiring, firing, training, retaining? And then are you willing to do the same thing when a partner calls up and says, this MF and blah, blah, you know, to one of your employees? You got to have the backbone to say it goes everywhere. You're going to call that partner, give them a chance to remedy. And if they don't, you say goodbye and you give them the name of the competitor. That does a lot for the culture inside, right? Because we know there will be more partners. We know there will be more clients. I'm probably not going to get that key employee back if I allow them to be treated that way. So important.
Definitely a way to get them to, you know, to buy in. So you've just talked about, you know, how you you integrated a culture in a business that you acquired. Tell us a bit about ProtectCell, and there you started. So
yeah,
were all of your, you know, kind of the values and the way that you see the business world, was that evident from day one at ProtectCell, or is that something that you know kind of grew and learned as you went?
Well, I think anybody who tells you it went exactly as the business plan goes is an absolute liar. You know, the first day you get punched in the nose, as they say, that the game plan changes. I had a good idea. I was also fortunate to have a business partner who is almost the exact opposite of me. Not super warm and fuzzy. Half a year of university in Windsor, a self-made guy, a very high-level thinker, and a constant learner, right? That's the thing we share together is we're constantly learning. So Rob Emery's his name, comes from the cellular industry, which can be a little cutthroat, if not a lot cutthroat. He had learned to make decisions quick, you know, build process, get it going. Wasn't that good, I would say, about the soft side of the people skills. And I definitely didn't have his business acumen in terms of what it would take being fully integrated top to bottom. And he just had a vision for that. So we outlined it and we built it. But quite frankly, we started with me, Rob, and Jennifer Roberts was our third employee. We grew to 125 employees, 125 million in revenue, doing business all over the globe. And we kind of did that where Rob worked on the inner guts of our business. And I certainly learned a lot from him. And I worked on the softer side of our business using EOS as well, which I'd used in a lot of my other businesses, entrepreneurial operating system, which builds a system on process and check in with people, right? We have weekly, monthly check-ins, quarterly building, and then annual planning. And that helps with the soft side. And I think we're able to put those two together and really have an impactful place. And what came out of that culture was, I remember we had an inflection point. We just turned $5 million in revenue, which was kind of selling the program in Rob's 30 stores and maybe about another 50 or 100. We got to 6,000 locations. We needed to decide what we were going to do next in marketing. And this is probably near and dear to your guys' hearts. Insurance had, you know, again, do you have abundance thinking or do you have scarcity thinking? Scarcity thinking says insurance has always been sold a certain way. And by the way, it's one of the most profitable commodities in the world and has been forever, right? Go back into the medieval times, it's been around. Some called it extortion at the time, but it's been insurance. The reality is with insurance, How does it work? You sell out of fear. Why do they call it extortion? Because you're extorting something from someone they don't want to give. That's out of fear, right? Out of duress. When you buy home insurance or car insurance, most likely it's the fear of something happening. We took a different approach, and you kind of tipped this in the beginning, Michael, that we wanted to say, rather than sell you on fear, the fear of losing your phone, which by the way is one of the top three anxiety creators in people's lives, death, divorce, and believe it or not, the loss of a phone, right? That moment of anxiety. You can add in, what if my house burned down, or, you know, safety of my children. There are other things that can be subbed in, but typically the top three, you take someone's phone away, the amount of anxiety they feel in that first 30 seconds is similar to those other thoughts. So we knew we could tap into that if we wanted to. Or we could say, we want you to buy ProtectCell because we think it is such a great value in what it protects for you that you wouldn't be without it. Now, I know words matter, so it's just a little nuance change. But your phone is a commodity and a device. We can get you a new one in 24 hours, so really don't worry about it. The reality is, what are you worried about? Your phone numbers, your text, your pictures, because at the time there was no iCloud. People were, you know, putting chips in and out of their phones. And if you lost that phone, you lost the 100 or 200 or 300 pictures, you know, whatever the capacity was. And the texts and the emails, I mean, you had to rebuild your life on that device. So we said, look, let us protect all of that. Let us give you that as the value, that we were the first backup service to do that as part of the program. So it wasn't called ProtectCell cell phone insurance. It was ProtectCell membership. You're belonging to a club of people that were protecting your digital identity, basically. Not like LifeLock, even though they were one of our partners. It was this suite of things that were connected to your phone. You know, single-handedly, we went from 5 million to 25 million, I think, within 13 months. We made the Inc. 200 at the time. We just couldn't almost stop growth for the, even if we mucked it up, which we did a lot along the way. That mantra from us and how it permeated into our marketing, you can imagine a call center full of people that were talking about delivering value instead of mitigating claims. One of our tenants was, we never denied a claim. If you said you lost or your phone was stolen, I didn't send you down to the 26th precinct in Detroit to get a police report. I mean, that literally would happen with our competitor, Asurion. If you were at a Tigers game, your car got broken into because you left your phone in the car, you'd have to go down and get a police report at the 26th precinct. What do you think the chances are of going into a Detroit police department and asking for a police report on a broken window for a cell phone? They got bigger, better things to do. It ain't happening. So your claim got denied. You're buying a new phone. We said, look, if you said it was stolen or it was broken, send us the broken device because we can do something with that. We can refurb it or we can recycle it. But if it was stolen, our guess is you don't want a secondary phone unless something really happened. Did people cheat the system? Of course. But for the 96% that weren't, we had the highest customer service rating, JD Power every year that we were in the program, you know, awards, the Sloan Business Award. We got tons of awards just for doing what we're doing. So, sorry, again, long answer to that. But it all started with that, you know, at the end, we were making our culture part of who we were, part of the product. We weren't different. We weren't different in the call center than we were in marketing, right? And oftentimes you see that. Hey, we're warm and fuzzy. But the call center is told to not do that. There's a disconnect. Something's going to have to give.
You know, and I think that's reflective of values, though. So often, and just kind of as a brand guy myself, you know, you see that distinction between a company's public persona and the way they actually either treat their people or treat their customers. And, you know, I guess one of the benefits, you know, probably of social media is companies are being called out for that. You know, if companies are proclaiming something but behaving in a different way, it's harder to hide that than it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago, right? Yep. But it sounds like what you're saying is that the values of the brand, the values of ProtectCell were the same throughout. The way that your customer would receive the service, the way that you all treated each other, and the way that you regarded your employees.
You know, the open statement is 100%. I'd love to tell you that happened all the time. You know, that was the fun of our work, is that we knew it didn't happen all the time. We missed the mark with messages. We had, because we sold through the independent dealer network, right? So a Verizon authorized dealer, an AT&T authorized dealer. We would get reports from people who said what was being told to them across the counter essentially was they sold on fear. They were scaring somebody into buying it. So we spent a lot of time on training. We spent a lot of time on auditing. We were okay with firing our customers, which were those cell phone dealers that were doing that. Their volume didn't suggest they should be sold or gotten rid of. They were doing great business for us. And you could, you know, you could easily say, well, who cares? If the customer calls us, we're going to take care of the problem. But then they have a problem, right? Because the messages aren't the same. So again, it was never 100% correct. But those that signed up with us, going back to the, you know, interview process for your employees and interview process for your partners, they knew what they were getting into. So none of them were shocked when we said, we're terminating our contract with you. You can no longer sell Protect Sell. It wasn't, well, why? Because we have a number of reports of people that were being sold differently than how we are as a company, because they are an extension of us. So just as one example, I think that is important, right? And that was, you know, essentially before real blown social media. We didn't care social media or not. But for us, it was reputation, right? Because we knew the successful stores that were doing it right told five others. They were our best marketing arm. And they always are. Your customers are your best marketers. So you can have brand, you can have message, you can have all of these things. You can have great culture back at home. You can spend millions of dollars telling others about it. But when your customers gush about who you are and they tell the true story of who you are, and then someone asks you and they hear the same story, you're not selling them at all. You're signing them up, right? What a great problem to have. You're taking orders.
So Brian, you know, that's a really, really exciting model that you just shared. And in I guess in marketing speak, you've moved from what I would call a differentiated to a distinct. Yeah, it's distinct. What or how did you get to that? I mean, is that, again, you talked about your colleague being, I guess, a bit more introspective, but, you know, what I wish I knew, how do teams get there? Because sometimes, and more often than not, as you know, and as you stated, people follow the norm.
Man, I wish I had the, you know, the little nugget soundbite. It came through time. And quite frankly, came through process for us of what are our values as a company. And those weren't different than the values we talk to our customers. So if I really had to distill it down, Simon, I'd say when you truly believe in the values of your company, right, of the people, first and foremost, I think the hardest thing in leadership is leading yourself. Right? So to borrow John Maxwell's statement, leading myself is the hardest. So when, you know, as go we, so go they. I say that to our staff all the time. As go you, so go they, meaning our customers, right? They're going to watch what you do, and so do our employees. So when we check our values a lot, making sure that none of them are aspirational, we talked a little bit about that earlier. You know, many companies like, we want to be the insert thing here. And you go, but you're not really doing that. No, but that's our aspirational goal. Well, then it's a goal. It's not a value. Good to work towards. And when you get there, it can be one of your values. And we've had plenty of those, right? Where we said, someday we'd like to be. But for right now, here's who we are. And we're really proud of that. And we will be that. When that is also what you do in the marketplace and someone's willing to say, I think that is different, and then you can do it the best in the world, right? To use Collins's thing. I mean, I know I'm crazy when I say that is the fun of business, because it's never good enough. Not in a demeaning, demoralizing, you'll never make it to the top thing. It's like those values becoming part of what your customers want. There's so much refinement that can happen there. How does it happen? You talk to your customers. Wow, newsflash, great idea. When you engage your customers or your partners or your clients in this dialogue of, we want to be closer to our values so that we can serve you. What you might find is they don't want to be your client. Thank you for saving us that time. We're chasing the wrong thing. You know what, guys, I really love it when you say this, but when I talk to somebody in your sales staff, quite frankly, it sounded a little pitchy. It sounded like what they're really selling me is more V1 or more Protect Sell. Thank you so much, Simon, for the feedback. That your honesty, number one, will get action. I will follow up with you on that. That's another great tenet, right? Do you follow up on what you say you're going to do? We will make it a priority in our business to make sure that happens. I can't tell you it's going to happen immediately, but we're going to make it a priority because it matches our values. What you didn't say is, you know, I wish Protect Sell also covered my motorcycle. Sure, what a sales guy will tell you is, no problem, I'll go back to home office, and if they don't do it, they're jerks. No, what I'm telling you is, if it aligns with our values as a company, we're right on it. Because if we're missing there, that's the real, real, I think, nugget there. Because then you're not selling. You're just saying, if you believe in our values, and you believe in the value of what we're promoting or selling in the marketplace, and it aligns with what you're looking for, and we're striving to be the best in the world at it, want to come on that journey with us? Because they'll never be good enough. So we'll always be refining, especially in software and product. We're always looking for a way to make it a little bit better, make it a little bit more efficient, make it a little more fun, easier, right? I mean, I could add a lot of words in. What's better than that? You're not working, right? You're solving, you're discovering, you're breaking stuff, you're failing. It makes it pretty awesome.
That's fantastic. So you're a venture capitalist. And now as you look at, you know, the choices you make with investments that you make, you know, some VCs would say, look, it's just the returns that matter, but you're different. Do you, number one, why do you do that? And number two, do you believe it costs you money?
I'll work backwards on that because it's not my money. So that's an easy one for me, because when we sold ProtectCell, Denise and I, before we had sold ProtectCell, we had decided in past businesses that we sold, we always decided what to give, right? Because we always wanted to give back. Regardless of what you believe, I just think it's healthy for us to say, where can we help? And money's an easy place to start. It's actually the easiest, right? Not to demean it, but it's just a commodity. So when we were building ProtectCell, we had High Velocity. We had another business we hadn't yet sold. We were in a really good spot. And so we said, we're going to give away a large chunk of our holding in the company. It had no dollar amount. It was just a percentage. Well, then you grow ProtectCell to our beyond our wildest imagine, and you sell it. A huge financial windfall for sure as a family. We were in a position we didn't have to work anymore, but we had already decided the percentage we were giving away. And as my business partner, Rob, will attest, he's like, do you know how much money that is? And I'm like, we're critically aware of it, but we already decided. And it was already earmarked for a foundation that we were going to run to help alleviate the pay-to-play conundrum in sport, because we feel that is such a limiting factor. So follow me on this journey for just a second, that in the year after retirement, I'm running the foundation with obviously some input from Denise, my wife. Money's going here, there, and wherever. I mean, literally, it's like anybody who needs it, we're giving it. I'm giving it, really. And after about a year, Denise said, okay, you're fired. You're doing a horrible job at this. There's no accountability. We've always said our feet will follow our money, so we can see what the impact is. Where can we help more? We weren't going to be a funding source. We were going to be like a seed of growth, right? That's how Opportunity Seed Foundation started. So Opportunity Seed Capital had not existed at this point. So as we're giving away money, I'm giving away money. The fund is going down. We don't take outside. We don't do fundraisers. We don't ask people to contribute to our foundation. We had believed we had enough in there that just through the growth of it in an account, it would be essentially an annuity that we could give out. Wrong when you give it away too fast or without direction. So I get fired, and Denise says, look, why don't you go do what you do best, which is invest in young guys that are starting businesses, help them grow. And if we get an investment in that company, or we take an equity position, if that company grows and becomes profitable, we'll take, you know, our portion of the cash and we'll replenish the foundation. If the company sells, we'll do the exact same thing. We'll take all that money. We're good on our own balance sheet, and we'll do that. So I'm saying that because whatever we go and do, whether I lose or gain, it's somewhat irrelevant, because the money's going into the foundation and is going to be given away. So, you know, I only get maybe a little bit irked that I wish it was more, because I'd love to give more. But quite frankly, that's not for me to decide, right? At the end of the day, the need is where it is, and we just follow that. So that's a starting point. And I think as then I go backwards, and you can see the journey there, it's investing in companies that I feel like I bring value to. Typically, that's going to be in sports and technology, or in places that need team leadership, right? High performing team leadership. So I'll give you an anomaly to that is I'm a partner at Ford's Garage, which is a restaurant. Billy Downs, who owned 30 restaurants, had tapped me, a good friend of mine, and said, what you can help me with is helping me as a leader form a high performing team. As you'd imagine, the restaurant business, especially in today's environment, it is crazy. Billy had done a good job his way and just wanted another way. So I felt I could bring value there. But what I don't do, and hopefully this answers the final part of your question, I really look at Opportunity Seed Capital as an investment company to grow time, treasure, and talent, not as a buzzword, but to say we're not venture. Because with venture, it is about playing the numbers. Venture actually in its description is, I invest in 10 things, two need to hit home run, three are probably going to fail, the five in the middle just get above the Mendoza line, and we rinse, wash, repeat. If that starts to break, internal pressures start to build. We just don't look at it like that. I'm not playing a numbers game. I'm looking at a time, treasure, talent. It's not a requirement that who we invest in. They do the same thing that we did at ProtectCell, but I'm batting 1,000 so far, because when people look at it, oftentimes it's that same thing. What did sport do for you? And you get this, wow, this dream. When I mention it to people, the idea of giving it away before you have it is really, it feels revolutionary, because oftentimes we get at the end and we go, well, gosh, if I was going to give away $1,000 or $10,000 or $100,000, you know, but if it was 5 or 10% of your business and your business grew to 10 million, you probably wouldn't give away a million, because you said 100,000 was enough, but you weren't thinking about 10 million. You were thinking about a million, right? So when you uncap the top, then the 10% just becomes math. It literally is just math. And I've found that some of those guys are like, I never thought I could give that much. Not because they didn't want to, because they were limited in thinking. And guess what? When you're limited in that thinking, the top line has a limit. But when you're unlimited at the top, man, that 10% can get pretty damn big. And I can at least tell that story that it had impact on our lives totally by accident, guys. This wasn't like Brian Finnerty and Denise Finnerty sitting down going, if we could just calculate this out. It worked out that way. So again, in retrospection, it's looking back and saying, man, if I could share that nugget, and that's how we invest. So people understand what our end vision is. Look, I'm not trying to squeeze more blood out of the stone from your company. Know that whatever this thing generates and you're willing to throw off, I know I want you to win first, because when you do, I'm going to win. Absolutely. If you don't win, I don't win. We're second at the table always. And we're going to make sure that what we get, we give. Right. So at least for our partners, they can understand that this isn't about Brian Finnerty trying to buy a G5. Right. I'm not looking to fly in a private jet. I'm not trying to buy a private island. I can tell you that we are good in life, and I'm super happy and thrilled. My kids are healthy. You know, my wife loves me today. That's great. And I'm in a place that, like, you know, we're good. And so if we can give more, it gets better. Right. I know that sounds way too Disneylandish, but quite frankly, we get to live it, which is good, right? And that's part of the story, what I wish I knew.
Wow. Well, Brian, this has been, I mean, an amazing conversation, and we really appreciate you taking the time to share your insight with us. And I know that, you know, coming away from this, I mean, there's a lot of thoughts running through my head. I know that people that listen to this will feel exactly the same way. And gosh, you know, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been great.
No, I appreciate you guys putting up with me for it and letting me kind of take a walk down memory lane. But I also appreciate what you guys are doing. You know, I mean, it really is so near and dear to my heart that this starts the conversation, right? What I wish I knew, because for especially the young men that I like to lean in and pour into, that's how I started. That if I was in your shoes, if I wrote that letter to myself earlier, this isn't going to be some old crotchety dude rocking in a rocking chair. I'm going to be brutally honest with you that I have mucked it up a number of times. I have, thankfully I have a wife that loves me today and a marriage today after 30 years, because there were times in there that my ego was so big, it almost broke and it was gone. So, you know, and I'm open and honest about all that stuff, because I think that's the essence of storytelling. It's, if you go back 100 years around the globe, and it's still happening in great places around the globe, I think especially Europe and Africa, telling story, and my wife is a part Native American, and it's definitely part of that culture as well. The telling story was so important because it was a connection, right? It was someone actually giving you the color and the context to the learning. It wasn't just about do this, do that. There's story in there. And so I do believe that's very important. That's why when I sit down with somebody, it isn't a list of to-dos and not to-dos. It's let me share with you what I've done. And if you can take something out of that, awesome. Or if there's a question you might have that gets me to think, I mean, I learn as much, right? When we give, we get. I'll be telling a story and I'll take something out of it the first time that I did when I was 25, right? Like, wow, thank you for asking that question. I hadn't even thought about that. I literally am a better man today because of what you just asked me. And that's the whole age and ability thing, right? That a 25-year-old can say, maybe I do have something. It's like, yeah, you do, right? It starts with a question. So appreciate it, guys.
Thank you, Brian. And your, you know, I guess your passion coming from your sports days, and what you've shared, you know, it's a sack full of wisdom there. So, there's lots of good examples and lots of good things for us to all take away today. So thank you for that.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.